This is polio, the cruel centuries-old crippler of children.
Some news programs treat vaccine safety as an issue for debate.
To the University of Michigan campus in 1955 came hundreds of scientists hoping to hear the words that would signal the end of polio's long and ruthless reign of terror.
We're not going to do that today.
Heading the medical men was Dr. Jonas Salk, whose polio vaccine had been tested and carefully evaluated. Reporters pressed forward to get the results the whole world was waiting for, rushed to their typewriters to spread the momentous news. The room was electric with expectancy. Then the historic announcement. The vaccine works. It is safe, effective, and potent.
The science is clear. Vaccines save lives.
Someday, said Dr. Salk, a vaccine may completely eradicate the menace of polio. Working at Pittsburgh University's...
And one of the leading defenders of vaccines is Paul Offit, a pediatrician who runs the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he's internationally recognized for his work. You may have seen him on the Colbert Report or read one of his op-eds in the New York Times. Paul joined me in D.C., to talk about vaccines, his latest book, Bad Advice, and what to make of the current political climate around science. Just a reminder that if you like Pulse Check, you can rate it on your favorite podcast app or share it with a friend. That always helps us find new listeners. And you can email me at ddiamond@politico.com with suggestions about the show. Paul Offit was a listener suggestion, and he was someone that I'd had on my list to interview too. And now, here he is. Paul Offit, welcome to Politico Pulse Check.
Thank you.
Simple question to start. A wave of Americans are opting out of vaccinating their kids. Our current president has suggested there might be a link between autism and vaccines. A major nation, Italy, just had a serious measles outbreak, and yet they are trying to roll back mandatory measles vaccinations. Paul Offit, are we doomed?
I think what's happening is anticipatable. So you didn't have to convince my parents to vaccinate me. I mean, they were children of the 20s and 30s. They saw diphtheria as a common killer of teenagers. They saw whooping cough as a killer. They saw polio as a crippler. They didn't have to be convinced. Similarly, I'm a child of the 50s and 60s. I had measles. I had mumps. I had German measles. I had chickenpox. I knew what those diseases felt like, so it was easy for me to know to vaccinate my children. But my children, who were 26 and 23, grow up at a time not only where they don't see these diseases, but they didn't grow up with these diseases. For them, it's a matter of faith. I mean, faith in whom? Faith in the pharmaceutical industry, faith in the medical establishment, faith in the government, and there's been an erosion in that kind of faith. So it's not at all surprising that there's pushback on vaccines. So I think what's going to happen is what's happening, which is that you see outbreaks. So for example, in this country, 2014, 2015, we had a big measles outbreak, and that caused California to crack down actually on its requirements to get vaccinated. They eliminated a philosophical exemption. They became the third state in the United States now to only have medical exemptions to vaccination. And so I think that's when it's going to be like a sine wave. You're going to see sort of outbreaks of infectious diseases, which is going to cause people again to be scared of the diseases, and then they'll get vaccinated, and then they will raise a generation of children who don't see those diseases, and then they won't be scared of them, and then you'll see a decrease in vaccination. I think it's going to go like that until the sun burns out.
So the pragmatic way of thinking about this is we're going to suffer some pain now for the privilege of trusting in the science again in the future.
It's a shame that it's come to that, because what that means is that children have to suffer to educate us, and it's unnecessary. We should learn from history.
And there are plenty of leaders, thinkers, activists who do believe in vaccine safety. Bill Gates, though, the philanthropist and Microsoft founder, says he's talked to President Trump, who has repeatedly floated the idea of a White House vaccine commission. How much should that scare Americans?
What didn't happen? I mean, RFK Jr. said that he was going to head a commission of vaccine safety and scientific integrity. First of all, there's already a commission of vaccine safety. It's called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There is an Office of Scientific Integrity. No sense reinventing things that already exist. And vaccines can stand on an excellent record, a mountain of evidence. I mean, when Donald Trump or those like Donald Trump say that, you know, they don't believe in vaccines, vaccines aren't a belief system. They're an evidence-based system, and they stand on a mountain of evidence.
We have listeners to this podcast who are specialists in public health and have spent decades working on issues like vaccines. We also have listeners who are Hill staff who maybe have just gotten into healthcare and have picked this issue up in the past year, or grad students who are making decisions on how they want to spend their careers. How would you explain how vaccines work to a broad audience who might not be specialists in this kind of field?
Right. So if you're naturally infected with a bacteria or virus, invariably you end up with immunity that will protect you from being infected with that bacteria or virus again. The goal of vaccines is to induce the immunity that occurs following natural infection without making you pay the price of natural infection.
You wrote a book a few years ago called Bad Faith about how religion undermines modern medicine. This administration is empowering religious liberty. We scooped this year that they were creating a conscience office to allow healthcare workers to opt out of procedures that they thought violated their religious or moral beliefs. Do you have any evidence, Paul, that this push for religious liberty is creating healthcare risks or undermining patient safety?
When I wrote the book, Bad Faith, it was based on the fact that there were two fundamentalist churches in the city of Philadelphia, neither of whom not only didn't believe in vaccination, but they didn't believe in healthcare. So when those children got measles, they didn't bring them into the hospital to get rehydrated when they were dehydrated, or they didn't bring them into the hospital for supportive care for their pneumonia. And so in a three-month period in Philadelphia, we had 1,400 cases of measles and 9 deaths. Think about that. That Disneyland outbreak in 2014-2015 was 189 cases in the country and no deaths. We had 1,400 cases and 9 deaths, and it scared me. And what happened was we eventually passed a series of laws that forced those parents to at least admit those children to the hospital and then ultimately forced them to get vaccines, even though there was a religious exemption to vaccination at the time. And when I asked those parents why they had done that, I mean, as a father, I certainly know that my number one job is to keep my children safe. How could they do that? They said, Jesus was my doctor. I put my faith in Jesus. And it struck me how profoundly unreligious that was as a thing to do. And I think that's in part what's going on here. I mean, religion teaches you to care about your children, care about your family, care about your community. And I think a lot of what's going on now is using religion as a shield to express some of your worst prejudices, your homophobia, your misogyny.
So you have evidence of religious exemptions causing trouble in Philadelphia or even around the country, but we don't know yet about the White House and this current administration's push on religious liberty.
I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see what they mean by it. My only concern is what they mean by the word religious. I would argue that religion in some ways teaches you to do the opposite of some of the things that the administration is pushing for.
Beyond the White House, you've met with multiple lawmakers in both parties about vaccine safety, about public health. What's your impression of how well science, vaccine safety is understood on Capitol Hill?
There are some congressmen and senators who very much embrace good science, and then there are those who simply hold on to beliefs that are directly averse to the evidence. And I don't think there's any political party that has a hold on rejecting vaccines. I think the Republicans or the right, if you will, rejected on the basis of sort of the libertarian notion, government off my back. You don't have to mandate vaccines. I will make the right decisions for my children, which will then be the right decision for society based on the information I gather. The problem is how one gets information. If you look on the internet, you can get a lot of bad information about vaccines that can cause you to make a bad decision. On the left, it's more the sort of natural, crunchy, granola, bib overall, anti-GMO, anti-bisphenol A, anti-gluten crowd, this notion that all natural is good. I mean, I would really like to know who Mother Nature's public relations team is because they've been doing a great job. Mother Nature has been trying to kill us ever since we crawled out of the ocean onto land. The only reason we live 30 years longer now than we did 100 years ago is because we have fought desperately against Mother Nature.
If Mother Nature's PR people are listening to this podcast, please write in because I have questions for you. So just to underline the point, Republicans, Democrats disagree on so many things in healthcare, the role of the Affordable Care Act and coverage expansion. But what you're saying is that both parties are roughly equal when it comes to issues like vaccine safety. Their objections just come from different places.
Yes, exactly.
You mentioned in your book a concerning story about meeting Senator Tom Harkin. And essentially, his desire, it sounded like, to weigh evidence from both sides. Can you explain that?
Right. So Harkin wanted to put into a bill that was currently in front of him a couple million dollars to study whether or not vaccines could cause brain damage. Now, it was sort of an ill-founded notion. There already had been many, many studies looking at the effect of vaccines on developmental issues, including autism and others. So it just seemed like it was money ill spent. It also seemed like it would create fear that didn't need to be fear. And so we met with him, me and a couple people like Amy Pisani from Every Child by Two and Betty Bumpers, the wife of Dale Bumpers. to talk to him about the data. And it was he was a nice guy. I think he was trying to get the information, and we talked at length about what studies were out there and how I think that that hopefully would have reassured him. And when we left, I was the last to leave. He sort of held my hand and wouldn't let go. And he looked me in the eye and he said, you know, I had people that were here a couple weeks ago that told me just the opposite of what you said. Why should I believe you? And I said, well, it really isn't about me. It's just about the data, the studies. I'm happy to send you the studies. I'm happy to go over the studies with you if you want. But he didn't take me up on that. He just looked into my eyes to see whether he could trust me. And he did. And he ended up not doing the bill he wanted to do. But and so we won. But I think feel like we won for the wrong reason. So we won because he trusted me, and it shouldn't have been about me. It should have been about the data. So, which made me believe that a charismatic scientist with poor data will be more effective than a more awkward science with excellent data.
And that's informed some of your writing and the desire that you've expressed for scientists to learn how to face off with celebrities, activists, politicians who have so much experience getting in front of a camera as opposed to the scientist. You write in your book about sitting in a small room studying mice and vaccine information doesn't exactly prepare you to go on national TV and have this fight out.
Right. I think inoculating mice for 20 years as I did in a windowless concrete blocked room at the Wistar Institute was not training for being on the Colbert Report. No.
Though it may have prepared you to be in our small room here doing this podcast, let's talk about your career. You just mentioned your research background at Wistar, a building that I ran by many times in Philadelphia when I was an undergrad there. Let's talk about your career. You're an author, you're a researcher, you're a physician. You're also a graduate of the Gilman School in Baltimore, an all-boys school that I know well. I went there too, a few years after you. And I know that Gilman teaches its students to focus on civility and politeness. So how did a graduate of that program, where we were taught to be so polite and respectful, become this fierce warrior against anti-vaxxers?
Well, I work in a hospital. And if you work in a hospital, you'll see a lot of tragedy. And this is a children's hospital. So there's not a year that goes by at our hospital where there's not a child who's admitted with a serious infectious disease that is vaccine preventable. They are admitted invariably because the parent chose not to vaccinate them, and occasionally they die from that disease. And the parent invariably made that choice because of something that they read on the internet or seen on television or read in a magazine, and it's unconscionable. I mean, there's so much in medicine that we don't know, but this we do know, which is that vaccines can prevent vaccine-preventable diseases and that we shouldn't allow children to suffer this way. And so that's it. I mean, I think I always have those children in my head whenever anti-vaccine people push back against me because the prize, the goal is to keep those children out of the hospital.
Well, you say that in a very scholarly way, but the reality sounds at times frightening. There have been anti-vaccine folks who have recorded you through windows. Your name has been put on the internet in various articles alleging that you have connections to big pharma. That skew your perspective. I'm sure there are people listening to this podcast, overwhelmingly people who will agree with you, but perhaps some anti-vaccine folks who will be listening for any sign that you are going to slip up and say something that undermines your position. How do you live with that on a daily basis?
Well, it's actually worse than that. I mean, I've had been physically harassed. I've been sued as a way of sort of just getting me to shut up, and I've been had death threats, 3 death threats that at least the FBI deemed credible. So, I mean, it's tough out there. But, you know, doing the right thing isn't the easy thing. I think that if you choose to stand up for children, and that's how I see myself here, I feel like I'm working in some ways against the cottage industry that is built on this notion that vaccines cause harm. And it's not true. And you see a lot of this. I mean, I think lawyers, personal injury lawyers at some level cash in on that fear. There are certainly people, if you ever go to these Autism One conferences in Chicago, there are people that sell a variety of cures for autism. You can detoxify your child from all these harmful vaccines. And it's hard to watch, and so you stand up. I think, you know, once I had to give a talk in Connecticut to a group of state legislators, and when it was over, a woman came up to me and just screamed at me because I had dared to say that, you know, vaccines didn't cause autism, but she knew that to be true because she knew her child had become autistic because of vaccines. And so she let me have it. And you never get used to this. It's never easy. But one of the state senators was giving me a ride back to the train station. She said to me, you know, you've gotten to the center of things when you meet the very best people and the very worst people. And so I've gotten to the center of things. But the good news is I've gotten to meet some really wonderful people who stand up for science, who do it for all the right reasons. And so on balance, it's been a win.
Has the anti-vaccine crowd ever made a good point?
I'm trying to think, have they ever made a good point? Not that comes to mind, no.
There was recently a decision from the vaccine court that seemed to suggest there was a link between vaccines and sudden infant death syndrome. Vaccine opponents seized on that as evidence of vaccines not working. Was there any merit in that decision?
No. So there are many studies showing that vaccines do not increase the risk of sudden infant death syndrome, which sort of was born actually in the 1980s associated with the pertussis or whooping cough vaccine. You know, the vaccine court is a place to settle disputes. It's not a place to determine scientific truths. Scientific truths are determined in scientific venues, not in court. And certainly in a scientific venue, that notion hasn't been borne out. And that's one of many decisions that's been made in vaccine court that has been refuted by scientific evidence. So, for example, they have compensated a woman who claimed to have gotten vaccines and that had caused her multiple sclerosis, where that certainly wasn't true. So, I mean, the courts are not a place to determine scientific truths.
So we've talked about whether anti-vaxxers have gotten anything right. What's the worst thing they've gotten wrong?
I think the worst thing that the anti-vaccine community puts out there is that you don't have to worry about what my child does. In other words, if I choose not to get a vaccine, that doesn't affect you because you're vaccinated. So what do you care? The implication there is that vaccines are 100% effective, and that's true of no vaccine. So interestingly, if you look, for example, at an outbreak of measles in the Netherlands in the early 2000s, this is going to sound counterintuitive. You were actually better off being unvaccinated in a highly vaccinated community than being vaccinated in a highly unvaccinated community. Obviously, you were best off being vaccinated in a highly vaccinated community. But the point being is that you were worse off being surrounded by a lot of people who weren't vaccinated, even if you were vaccinated, than if you weren't vaccinated, living in essentially a moat around you that would protect you. And that's in California, when they overturned their philosophical exemption. That's the argument they made. Because remember, it's a country of 300 plus million people. There's about 500,000 people who can't be vaccinated because they're getting cancer chemotherapy or they're too young to be vaccinated. There was a little boy who stood up. His name was Luke. He said he was in the induction phase of chemotherapy for his leukemia. And he said, "What about me? I depend on you to protect me." And I think, you know, it's so selfish, so wrong to think that what you do doesn't have an impact on other people when it certainly does.
You talked to the Daily Beast, a publication, and that was then paraphrased and quoted in the New York Times this month, suggesting that media shouldn't cover studies that could scare the public. Specifically if the study maybe didn't meet some threshold. How is that mentality good for science, if the media should avoid certain topics out of fear of alarming people?
Right. So when Melinda Moyer wrote that op-ed for the New York Times, she should have fully quoted me. She never interviewed me. She simply quoted me from something I'd written in the Daily Beast. The article that she was referring to was an article that had shown that, or had claimed to show, that the influenza vaccine given in pregnancy in the first trimester increased one's risk of spontaneous abortion. Now, there are six other studies that showed that wasn't true. The study that she was talking about was a substandard study. What I said in that Daily Beast piece is I went through piece by piece why it was that paper should have never been published. So it's not that I think good science that shows that vaccines have safety problems shouldn't be published. I think that bad science shouldn't be published, and that's what happened here. I mean, vaccines, like anything you put into your body, have positive effects and negative effects. Certainly vaccines have safety issues. The oral polio vaccine that we use in this country could itself cause polio. Gelatin-containing vaccines, and there are a couple, can increase your risk of so-called immediate type hypersensitivity or allergic reactions. That's why you stay in the office for 15 minutes after you get a vaccine. Measles-containing vaccine can lower your platelet count transiently. It can cause you to have these sort of so-called petechiae, little broken blood vessels. So vaccines do have side effects, just not the ones that are claimed by the anti-vaccine crowd. I mean, vaccines don't cause autism. They don't cause diabetes. They don't cause hyperactivity. They don't cause multiple sclerosis. They don't cause those chronic diseases. So get it right.
Something I worry about as a journalist, that by calling attention to a controversy, even to fact check it, I'm giving it a spotlight anyway. That by writing about the neo-Nazi protest recently in Washington, D.C., that someone somewhere who hadn't heard of their ideas might end up liking them. Do you ever worry, Paul, that on some level, by attacking anti-vaxxers, you might end up helping spotlight them and give them legitimacy?
Well, I see myself more as reactive to them. I mean, the anti-vaccine folks are a reality. They're not going anywhere. I mean, you can try and ignore them, but they're not going to go away. I think that what I tried to do when I entered this, I guess in the late 1990s, early 2000s, was I thought as a scientist that it would be good to have someone with this basic science background, which is what I do, to address this. I mean, at the time, I think the pediatricians were standing up and saying, you know, vaccines are good, vaccine preventable disease are bad. I think the public health people were standing up, but I didn't see a basic scientist in there showing not only that this wasn't true, but why what they were saying wasn't true, why it didn't make biological sense that it would be true. So that's what I thought I could contribute. I certainly have learned the hard way about how to interact with the media. I've made many, many mistakes, but I think I've gotten a little better over time. But it's definitely a challenge. It's sort of like Lost in Translation or Innocence Abroad or something. That would have been a better title for the book.
What are the mistakes that you feel like you've made with the media?
Well, the first mistake, and I guess the most obvious one, although it took me a while to learn it, is that you don't have to answer the question exactly as asked. Sometimes people ask you questions that, you know, if you actually fully answer that question, we'll probably set healthcare information back about 20 years. So you have to be careful about that. I think and to be comfortable, to be in a situation you're comfortable. Also, don't go on a show when the host isn't on your side. You can't possibly win in that situation. Make sure you have the backing of your institution. I think when you take on certain controversial areas, which was true for me when I took on the issue of the smallpox vaccine in terms of whether it should be given routinely. This was during the George W. Bush administration, and the CDC both sort of supported that program. I didn't. And, you know, our hospital gets federal funds. You need to make sure that you aren't going against your hospital.
In your book, and you do have this new book out, Bad Advice, on why celebrities and activists and politicians are misleading. You're competing with Omarosa on the bestseller list this week. You talk about going on the Colbert Report and prepping for that, which I thought was interesting, the idea that you're not on there to be funny. You're on there to just get your message out and stick to it regardless of whatever pies he's throwing at you in the conversation.
You know, first of all, Colbert was great. I think the comedians generally have been great. It's like the old George Bernard Shaw line, if you're going to tell people they're wrong, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. And I think he met with you beforehand. He tells you, I'm going to play a character. I'm going to stay in character this entire interview. Don't let my character get away with anything. I agree with you.
All right, I'll bite. Why should I vaccinate my kids?
Because vaccines have saved our lives. I mean, before
they seem perfectly healthy right now.
So he's on your side. I think what you learn in that situation is they never tell you the questions in advance. They just give you a series of interviews as the do's and don'ts of the Colbert Report. I think what you learn is that that it's a comedy show, that you are a straight man on a comedy show. Get used to it. Don't make jokes. People aren't there to laugh at you. They're there to laugh at Stephen Colbert, often at your expense. If you happen to get any information out there about vaccines, consider it a win. But people, again, aren't there to learn about vaccines. They're there to laugh at Stephen Colbert. So you just strap in. It's like you're an astronaut about to blast off and just take whatever comes.
I am entirely motivated by fear. And if I don't see something around me to fear, I think a little outbreak, not a bad idea.
Yeah, so,
I don't want anybody to get sick.
One more media question. I asked you once years ago about the consequences for reporters who spread faulty or misleading information about vaccines. You suggested in the moment, and you write about this in your book, as we found out before sitting down for this podcast, you suggested that there could be, quote, journalism jail for reporters who get it wrong and are contributing to problems in public health. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Right. I think there should be a consequence. When people publish an article that's clearly wrong, that scares people about, in this case, vaccines, that causes them to make bad decisions for their children, that puts those children at unnecessary risk and where there could be harm, that they should be accountable for that. And you know, we have a First Amendment in this country. Obviously, absent malice, you can write things that are wrong in the newspaper. You're allowed to say things that are incorrect to the American public. But I think there should be a consequence. And journalism jail was not a real jail because we do have a First Amendment. But what it is more of a sort of a panel of journalists who judge whether or not somebody crossed the line. And if they did, then they have to give a certain amount of money to something that ultimately, say, trains journalists in journalism school or something like that.
It's wishful thinking, especially given the pocketbooks of journalists these days. Who should Americans trust at the end of the day? It's hard if there's a lot of news coming at the average person. How much fact-checking does the average American need to do on what's coming into his or her feed?
It's a good question. In the world of medicine and science, I think most people don't have the background that they need to actually do that. I mean, for me, it would be a matter of, say, car repair. I don't know anything about cars. I mean, I open up the hood and it just looks very busy to me. And so I trust the mechanic. I try and find somebody I trust and trust them because I'm not going to know. A surgeon. I mean, if a surgeon is going to take out my gallbladder, I trust that they're going to know what to do. I'm not going to sort of look on the internet and then argue with them about how best to make an incision.
Are you blindly trusting, or is it more trust and but verify, get a second opinion? Because there should be some skepticism, right? If we believed based solely on expertise, it's possible to be misled even by the best healthcare practitioners.
Right, but how are you going to get information? So let's take an example. Let's suppose this happens to me all the time. Somebody calls and says, look, I've done my research on a chickenpox vaccine. I've decided not to get that vaccine. But what do they mean by research? What they mean is they've looked on the internet and read people's opinions about that vaccine. They haven't read the roughly 300 articles out there on the chickenpox vaccine, which require them to have some working knowledge of virology, statistics, molecular biology. They're not going to have that. And frankly, most doctors don't have that. And so who do we look to? We look to the experts that comprise advisors committees to the CDC or advisory committees to the American Academy of Pediatrics that at least collectively have that expertise, collectively can make that decision. That's the best decision for our children. But that is a tough sell in 21st century America. Trust us, we're experts. That doesn't sell very well. Although in general, our experts have served us well in this particular arena. So I think when you choose to take that on your own, you do it at some risk. You're really just depending on other people's opinions because you generally don't have that expertise. I mean, if I can look up stuff about my car, but I really don't have any experience or expertise in the area. So ultimately, what I can do is I can go to friends and ask them who they trust, I mean, as a mechanic. But here, it would be, you know, what doctor do you trust? It's hard. I mean, you know, the science is built on evidence, but the fact is that there are 6,500 medical and scientific journals in this world. There are 4,000 papers that are published every day in the world's medical and scientific literature, and they follow, not surprisingly, a bell-shaped curve. Some are excellent, some are awful, most are more or less mediocre. You can find a paper that says anything you want it to say. I mean, there's, you know, the Flat Earth Society still has a website. It's hard out there to sort out all that information. So my general feeling is trust people who have an expertise in the subject.
Got it. So that clarification that you should go to the best and the brightest whenever possible.
Yes.
Who's your arch nemesis? Is it Andrew Wakefield? Is it Jenny McCarthy? Is it RFK Jr.?
My arch nemesis makes me sound like a superhero. No.
Some might say that you are fighting for vaccine safety.
My arch nemesis is a significant percentage of the population that believes that there's a conspiracy to hurt them, that conspiracy is comprised of the pharmaceutical industry and the medical establishment and the government. And so no matter how good your information is and no matter how well you can get that information into the public, there is a certain percentage you're never going to convince. And I think it's worse. I think that's where – I mean, I think that the current administration, that Trump's ascension at some level was built on the notion that there's a deep state, that there's this something working against you and that you should trust him. I mean, it's what demagoguery is built on. I'll give you a specific example. So my wife the other day forwarded me an email from a friend who wanted me to know or to comment on what I thought about a particular article that she had read. The article was about this enzyme that had been discovered in vaccines called NAGLase, which was a cancer-causing enzyme. Now, that's not true. First of all, although there is such a thing as NAGLase, it's not a cancer-causing enzyme. It's just a enzyme that's associated with this lysosomal storage disease. But in any case, so that was wrong too. But that in any case, five doctors had discovered this enzyme, discovered that it was causing cancer, and that all had been murdered. What did I think of that? What do I think of that? I think it's crazy. I think it's InfoWars crazy. I mean, how can a reasonable person ask that question? Even just a couple days ago, I was asked by a guy who runs a website called Outbreak News, which is perfectly legitimate, news about outbreaks, real outbreaks. Would I comment on something in Natural News that shows that the measles vaccine is actually killing more people than measles? Well, 125,000 people die a year from measles. Do I think that there's the measles vaccine's killing hundreds of thousands of people? Of course I don't think that. Why do I have to comment on that? Why should I comment on that? I mean, when I was younger and I would, you know, walk through the grocery stores in Baltimore, Maryland, you know, there would be the National Enquirer, which would have a headline like dwarf rapes nun flees in UFO. I mean, now you're being asked to comment on that. Do you think that could happen? No, I don't think that happened either.
One of the scariest conversations that I've had with my older relatives are sentences that begin with six words. I was searching on the internet. And there's always something out there that's going to undermine. Let's think then about institutions, the role of institutions in protecting and spreading good information. The government spent decades running PSAs on vaccine safety, getting everything from scientists talking straight to the camera to characters from Star Wars promoting the need for vaccines.
Come along, R2. You can't have whooping cough. Droids don't get dangerous diseases like whooping cough or measles, but children do, and they can get very sick. Even die.
Should our government be doing more to stress the safety, or would that just contribute to the fears that institutions are trying to undermine Americans' health?
I think the public needs to understand this process better. I feel like if anybody went to a so-called Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices meeting, they would see a group of people who care desperately to get it right. The pediatricians, infectious disease experts, epidemiologists sitting around the table trying to look at all the data and make the right decision. A decision that when they're considering it, the number one thing they think is, would I give this vaccine to my own children or to my grandchildren or whatever? That's who does this. I think people can vilify the process in large part because they don't understand it. So I think what our task should be is to make this process far more transparent, meaning visible. And I don't think we do a very good job of that. It's just seen as this sort of black box from which emanates a recommendation, and where did that all come from?
So some of that's on scientists, some of that is on the institutions that promote science. Could Hollywood be any better in how they portray medical science and vaccines specifically?
Sure. Although there are good things that come out of Hollywood. I think Steve Soderbergh's movie Contagion was excellent. I mean, it actually described contagiousness. The vaccines were the hero of that story. And vaccines, it was hard to make them. I mean, it was, you know, fail before finally something worked. It got at it, I thought, pretty well. I mean, the movie Outbreak was a little more fanciful. I mean, things that would have taken years took minutes in that movie. But nonetheless, I mean, they took on the notion of what an outbreak could look like and how one could stop it. So I think anything that sort of involves science is generally a good thing. So I think they certainly can do more. The day after, although, you know, talking about sort of the horror of climate change, although there were a number of things in that movie that were scientifically not accurate, it still elevated the notion of what climate change could ultimately lead to, and that wasn't wrong. So, not sure, they could do more.
If Hollywood is directionally correct, that might be better than being totally falsiful, is I think what you're saying.
Right.
Contagion, for listeners who haven't seen that movie, it shows the progress of disease over days and dead bodies piling up. It's also a movie that I went on a date to with someone in healthcare. Worst date movie I've ever been to.
Is there any way someone could weaponize the bird flu? Is that what we're looking at?
Someone doesn't have to weaponize the bird flu. The birds are doing that.
You definitely do not want to be sitting near anyone when watching that movie about how viruses spread and people die. In addition to being an author, a physician, you're a scientist. You've worked on vaccine development. What's your favorite vaccine, not counting the ones that you may have made?
The Hib vaccine, which prevents a bacterium called Haemophilus influenzae type B. That was the bane of my residency. I mean, I was a resident in pediatrics in the late 1970s at a time when there were 25,000 cases a year of this bacterial infection, which presented either as a bloodstream infection, pneumonia, or something that people don't see anymore, but was the single most frightening disease I dealt with as a resident, something called epiglottitis. When your epiglottis swells to the point that it blocks your airway and causes you to suffocate. When those children would come into the hospital, the slightest movement, anything that scared them could cause them to suffocate. And so we had a special room for those kids, a room that was dark, a room that had an aquarium in it. We would sort of gently bring them into that room, and then the anesthesia team would come down and gently bring them upstairs where they could then intubate them. But, you know, you couldn't really transport those kids easily because, you know, when you're in an ambulance and it's loud and noisy, a spasm of that epiglottis could cause them to die on the spot. And it's very hard to insert a tracheostomy tube in an ambulance. So that was the scariest disease. The Hib vaccine, which came about in the 1990s, virtually eliminated that disease. Now, instead of having 20 to 25,000 cases a year, we have fewer than 50 cases a year. Most residents at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where I am now, have never seen a case of Haemophilus influenza B disease. That vaccine, for me personally, showed the power of vaccination.
I'm someone who believes in vaccines. What vaccines should I get that I have not? What vaccine should the average American get that he or she hasn't had?
Well, so as an adult, you should get the influenza vaccine every year. As an adult, you should get the tetanus diphtheria vaccine every 10 years. As an older adult, meaning if you're over 50 years of age, which you're not, but were you over 50 years of age, you should get the shingles vaccine, which prevents one of the most painful diseases of man. And you should get the pneumococcal vaccine, which is a bacterial vaccine that prevents a common cause of pneumonia.
We talked earlier at the beginning of this conversation about the arc in history of vaccine safety followed by vaccine skepticism. How do you see the next 10 or 15 years playing out? Are we at the lowest point yet for trust in vaccines, or is it going to get significantly worse?
Actually, I think we've come back a little from our lowest point. I think our lowest point really was in the late 90s, early 2000s, when a number of things had happened then. I mean, there was the Andrew Wakefield claim that measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism. There was a rotavirus vaccine called RotaShield that was developed by NIH researchers in collaboration with Wyeth that was taken off the market after 10 months because it was found to be a cause of intestinal blockage. There was a concern that thimerosal, this ethyl mercury-containing preservative in vaccines, might actually be causing developmental delays, including autism. And you know, the Public Health Service, I think, scared the public a little bit by taking that out of most vaccines given to young children in a somewhat precipitous and frightening manner, and gave birth to groups like Generation Rescue or Save Minds or Moms Against Mercury. That episode actually increased the number of anti-vaccine folks to get into this, and vaccines were on the run then, I think. But I think now what happens is you see what happens when you scare people about vaccines to some extent unnecessarily, and immunization rates drop. You see outbreaks, and then you see something happen like what happened in California when Richard Pan, a very brave Democratic senator, stood up and said, "I'm going to propose a bill that eliminates philosophical exemptions in the state of California." Right, the last place you think they would eliminate a philosophical exemption. So California becomes then the third state that only has medical exemptions in this country because they were the epicenter of an outbreak of measles that occurred in 2014, 2015. Plus, you're starting to hear the voices of parents who are saying, what about me? What about my children? I mean, my children are being – vaccines aren't 100% effective. I mean, I'm now in a region where there's more and more children choosing not to get vaccinated, or whose parents are choosing not to vaccinate them. That puts my child at risk, even if my child's immunized, that still puts my child at risk.
Because the immunity of the herd has fallen, and that then lets measles and other diseases spread.
And it's always measles, right? I mean, measles is the canary in the coal mine because it is the most contagious of the vaccine-preventable disease, so that's always the first one to come back. But it scares people. It should scare you. I think part of the problem, and Jenny McCarthy echoed this when she said, as she does so eloquently, I'll take the frickin' measles every time, the implication being that the choice is getting a measles-containing vaccine and thus putting your child at risk of autism, which isn't true as compared to getting measles, which is what happens when you don't get a vaccine. Measles makes you sick. Measles, 50% of people with measles actually have abnormal chest x-rays. When people come into the hospital, our hospital, with fever and a rash, I'm often called down to the emergency department because I'm an older person who's seen a lot of measles, and I can tell in 30 seconds whether somebody has measles because you can tell how sick they are. What Jenny McCarthy says when she says, "I'll take the measles every time," is that not only have we largely eliminated measles, we've eliminated the memory of measles, about how sick it can make you. So we now can boldly proclaim that we're willing to get a disease which killed 500 people a year in this country and caused 48,000 to be hospitalized before we had a vaccine.
Well, let's hope measles stays on the run and we have really reached the nadir. So what's next for you? Bad Advice is your eighth book. You're still seeing patients. Where do you see the next number of years in your career?
I take it one step at a time. I am working on another book, which is tentatively titled Too Much Medicine, because I think the pendulum has swung, a little too far in medicine to overdiagnosis and overtreatment. I think we do more than we need to, which I think at some level has resulted in harm. So I'd like to write a book about that. And then otherwise continue to see patients, continue to run our vaccine education center, continue to try and create and distribute educational materials and fight the good fight. And I'll continue to do that as long as I can think straight.
Well, thank you for fighting the good fight on Politico's Pulse Check podcast. Paul Offit, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for Pulse Check today. My thanks to Paul Offit for coming down from Philadelphia and Micaela Rodriguez, who recorded the podcast safely behind a glass wall away from any diseases that might be spread, though she assures me she has all her vaccines. You can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.